Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Bangladesh is a nation of rivers. The mouths of South Asia's holiest rivers, the Ganges, the Padma, the Yamuna, and more, exit through Bangladesh and into the Bay of Bengal. That same water makes Bangladesh one of the most climate-vulnerable countries in the world. Floods, cyclones, storm surges. Over the past decade, hundreds of thousands of Bangladeshis have been displaced by climate disasters. And it's estimated that by 2050, 1 in 7 people in Bangladesh will have to move because of sea level rise alone. That's potentially 18 million people, more than twice the entire population of New York City. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
While contributing less than 0.47% of global emissions, Bangladesh is one of the most climate vulnerable countries.
This month, at the 26th UN Climate Change Conference in Glasgow, Bangladesh's Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina did not mince words about how climate change is changing Bangladesh. She gave a specific example of how its tentacles are pulling together the environment, the economy, and human rights.
We are trying to address the challenges of climate impact because of 1.1 million forcibly displaced Myanmar nationals or Rohingyas. Because of their staying in Bangladesh, actually those areas become deforested. So it's a big challenge for us.
Recall that Prime Minister Hasina pointed out that Bangladesh is responsible for less than 0.5% of all global carbon emissions. In a later session, she pointed to the world's richest countries, responsible for about 80% of carbon emissions, and their failure to financially support mitigation efforts in the global south.
Global adaptation actions are not being effective due to lack of finance and political will. To address this, developed countries must fulfill their commitment of annual $100 billion climate finance with 50-50 allocation for adaptation and mitigation. The Paris Agreement must be fulfilled.
So the Bangladeshi Prime Minister there calling on the richest countries in the world to fulfill promises made more than half a decade ago. But what if it's time to think of these promises in a completely new light? Prime Minister Hasina talked about the disproportionate impact of climate change. So what if it's time to think about the moral necessity of both repairing the climate and some kind of climate reparations? Well, that's what we're going to take a look at today. And we'll start with a deeper look at climate and Bangladesh. And Ritan Kuya joins us. He's Bangladesh-based field coordinator who's helped international news outlets cover climate change for the past decade. He happens to be with us today from New York. Ritan, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So first of all, describe to me what sort of the annual weather cycle was like in Bangladesh when you were a small child.
So honestly, I heard in 1970 that was maybe the biggest or largest or strongest cyclone. Its name at the time, there was no name for cyclone. It's called, nowadays it's called Cyclone Bola. So maybe 500,000 people died in 1970. And it was very close to my house. My home district is Noakhali, the southern side of Dhaka. And Bola is very, very close, just west. And my mother, she said in that way, so thousand people died. Even she saw those types of things. In 1988, at the time, we saw flood. In 1991, we saw again cyclone. There was no name for cyclone at the time in Bangladesh. But the very recently, like 2006, Sidor, then 2009, Ampa, Aida. So in that way, it is gradually increasing. And nowadays, when I work in the field, mainly in southern side of Bangladesh for international media or for research work for University of Texas, I have been seeing people, they would like to say in their lifetime, when they were very young, like me, they didn't see lots of cyclone in 1 year. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, there is more than two or three or four cyclones coming, and those are very strong.
So you've gone, as you're saying, you've gone from your childhood in 1970 to, you know, maybe one big one to lots of big cyclones in, or many big cyclones in Bangladesh every year. What happens in the past, or has happened in the past several years, every time one of those cyclones comes through? What happens to the people who are living, especially in the Ganges River Delta area?
So whenever cyclone is coming, it is honestly affecting from all sides. Mm. Like if I say like schools, children cannot go. So everything is damaging their house. Then the embankment, you know, the southern side of Bangladesh, almost everywhere there is embankment. Maybe Dutch people, they call it polder, but in Bangladesh, we call it embankment. So embankment is coming down, and the saline water is coming inside, and the livelihood, the people's lives. So everywhere, you cannot say like something is remaining. Everything is going for cyclone. Uh-huh. So everything, livelihood to fish, crops to people's lives, school to sanitation, roads to bridges. So everything going down or damaging.
Right. So school, fishing, crops, sanitation, where people can actually live. And this isn't just because of the cyclones. As you said, also, you have this constant sea level rise, too, that's keeping the problem like permanent almost year round.
Yes. So honestly, in that area, in southern side of Bangladesh, where I'm based in Noakhali, in the same time where my working area, so those areas, water level, and nowadays the embankment, those are very close to the water level. And when the cyclone is coming, and even at the time, if there is high tide and low tide, so the full moon or half moon time is connecting with the cyclone, at the time sea level water is going much, much upper and upper. So before cyclone, you can see in some point in Shaktira district in Gabura Island, so the water at the time on the top of the embankment, so water already started coming, but there is no cyclone yet. Maybe it will come maybe 3 hours later or 4 hours later. So at the time, and poor people, uneducated people, they would like to stay in their house as long as possible. And some people, they take risk for their life. They don't like to leave from their house. They don't like to go in cyclone shelter. So water level and sea water level already increased. And in the in low tide and high tide time and cyclone time, it is much upper position.
So one more question for you, Ritan, if I could. You know, I quoted earlier those numbers about how already annually there are hundreds of thousands of Bangladeshis displaced, and that number could go into, you know, up to 18 million in just a couple of decades, because one in seven Bangladeshis could be permanently displaced by climate change. What's the potential impact of that on Bangladesh? Is the nation prepared to cope with this fundamental transformation of where people can live?
So in Bangladesh, it's a very small country like a New York City, and lots of people. We call in the government the amount is like 160, but regular people, we think it will be 200. So every year, in the last couple of years ago, the students, when they complete their education, they try to go in Dhaka for a job. But nowadays, the total family needs to move in Dhaka because nothing is remaining in the countryside. I do not have any specific data, but from some reports I have seen, like 1,000 to 2,500 people are heading the city areas almost every day. Mm. And I know some areas like Gabura Island in 2009, after Cyclone Ayla, there was a survey completed by a local NGO. They show within 2 years, 688 family moves. And if you count five family members in each family, then it will be 3,500 or 4,000 people after one cyclone. And I know another place, it is in Ramjannagar in Shatkira district. So there were 314 families, now only 88 families living. Ah. So each and every day, families, so this is like accountable, or you know this because local NGO is working, but you don't know many things. and how many people are joining or coming in the main city, and it will be a disaster because their life is very vulnerable. They don't know the train track. They don't know the main road. They don't know the exit, which location they need to go in Dhaka city. So it is an unbelievable situation because government cannot control everything. And you know, this is bad. Bangladesh. So,
yeah,
it is not going in a systematic way. It's not like a USA. It's Bangladesh.
Well, let me just play a very quick clip here from President Joe Biden also talking about funds for the Global South here. Here's what he said.
At the United Nations in September, I announced that my administration is working with the Congress to quadruple our climate finance support for developing countries by 2024, including a significant increase in support for adaptation efforts. This commitment is made possible to each of our collective goals of mobilizing $100 billion annually for climate finance, but mobilizing finance at the scale necessary to meet the incredible need is an all-hands-on-deck effort.
Ritan, we only have 1 minute left here, but what difference would it make to a nation like Bangladesh if the industrialized countries of the world did indeed make good on their promises of that $100 billion annually a year for climate efforts?
So it would be good, but honestly, the local people, they're pretty angry with the government organization because the local people, or I as a Bangladeshi, I think the government institute, they are not working properly. But people are very happy with a local NGO or international NGO. They think or they believe that the aid or what kind of things are coming, they are getting those things directly. And sometimes one thing I would like to share, the local people, they would like to say, we do not need any aid. We need our embankment, because they believe the embankment of that kind of thing, they will be able to, that will be able to protect their life.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes they do not need to move from Dhaka. So
right.
In that,
well, Ritan Kia? Kuya, a field coordinator and producer based in Bangladesh, who's worked for a number of international news organizations. Thank you so much for joining us today, Ritan. We'll have more about the concept of climate reparations when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the concept of climate reparations, what it means, what it would look like, and why some are calling for a new moral framework on the urgency to repair the climate. And one of those people is Olufemi Taiwo, an assistant professor of philosophy at Georgetown University. He says it's high time for a new way to think about climate change.
There are deep connections between the use of coal by some of these empires who were building, and later the use of oil, and this racially charged history. If you want to rebuild the world in the direction of justice, it's not achievable unless we respond to the climate crisis at scale.
Taiwo was calling for climate reparations to make up for that historic climate injustice. He says because the economic success of the world's richest nations is directly tied to their high carbon emissions.
But also, we're talking about political control and political power. It's not just who has money and who can buy things, but it's who can exert control over the decision-making bodies that explain why Madagascar and Mozambique have the worst kind of problems dealing with climate crisis and have insufficient support from the international community, while those same institutions help create the political and economic rules that explain why the wealth ends up in the U.S. and the U.K. rather than Madagascar and Mozambique.
Taiwo says the international community now has to discuss matters like cash transfers, developing sources of renewable energy, and other efforts to help climate issues in the global south.
We run into obstacles when we try to make reparations smaller than I think it should be. We're talking about rebuilding the world. We're not talking about a one-off policy. We're not talking about one check that gets sent out one time. We're not talking about a kind of apology that we do before we get back to business as usual. We're talking about changing what business as usual is.
Olufemi Taiwo, Assistant Professor of Philosophy at Georgetown University. Well, joining us now is David Wallace Wells. He's Deputy Editor of New York Magazine and author of the book Uninhabitable Earth, and he also recently wrote an article in New York Magazine titled Climate Reparations, A Trillion Tons of Carbon Hangs in the Air, but they're put there by the world's rich, an existential threat to its poor. Can we remove it? David, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So first of all, the idea of reframing climate as an issue of morality, especially moral choices between the industrialized or richest countries in the North versus the entirety of the global South, is a very, very compelling one. But questions of morality can also be a little gauzy. So can you put some more specific details around what it is that you're talking about, in your article, when you say it's time to really think about what the industrialized nations of this world should do because of the moral imperative behind it?
Well, I think it's useful to start from a basic scientific fact that I think most people don't totally appreciate about carbon dioxide, which is the main greenhouse gas heating the planet. And that's that it doesn't dissipate. It actually sticks around in the atmosphere once it's up there for centuries and possibly millennia, which means that any amount of carbon that's been put up there since the beginning of industrialization is still heating the planet today. It'll still be heating the planet 100 years from now. It'll still probably be heating the planet a few hundred years from now, unless we take it out in the interim. And that means, among other things, that the crisis that we see today with the unprecedented wildfires all through California, but also across Siberia, so intense that actually wildfires have released more carbon into the atmosphere this year than the United States economy as a whole, through the flooding events, the Pacific heat dome, you know, the just incredible climate-driven famine in Madagascar, many other impacts besides. That crisis that we see on our news today is the result of stuff we've already done in the past. At climate conferences like the one that's going on in Glasgow, we talk a lot about present emissions and future emissions because those are incredibly important to get under control. But we're at the crisis point today, and many of the poorest countries of the world are suffering already because of what's happened already. And the overwhelming majority of that has been by the rich countries of the world. Mm. Something like 80% of historical emissions have been produced by the G20. And a huge portion of that actually has been by the United States, something like a fifth of all emissions that have ever been produced, which is more about double the second place country, China, which of course has three times as many people. So when you calculate it on a per capita basis, the American guilt is much, much bigger still.
Okay, well, so then the first question that comes to mind in that case is it's actually a similar one when people grapple with, say, the idea of reparations for slavery, and that is you're basically talking about a time period that dates back to what, to the mid 19th century and the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, and what is the current moral obligation of people living today to repair damage that was initially done many generations ago, and at a time where, you know, people were pulling carbon out of the ground, essentially, to, I'm going to borrow a phrase from Dickens here, to power those mad, melancholy elephants, the great machines of the industrial revolution. But they did not know what the impact of putting all that carbon in the atmosphere would be. So why impose sort of a sense of moral, you use the word guilt, this moral framework on people now for actions, you know, begun 170 years ago?
Well, the first point is the one I mentioned earlier, which is just that because of the lasting power of carbon, stuff that was done a long time ago is still having an impact. But much more important in terms of adjudicating sort of our individual, or I think more importantly, national responsibility, is the fact that actually very little of this was done a long time ago. More than half of all of the carbon emissions that have ever been put into the atmosphere since the beginning of humanity have been put there in the last 25 years. 90% have been put there in the lifetime of Joe Biden. 25% of them have been put there since Joe Biden was elected vice president in 2008. This is very much something that we are doing now and with full knowledge of the risks we are undertaking, which is to say the full knowledge of the burden that we're imposing elsewhere in the world. So the first testimony before the U.S. Senate about global warming took place in 1988. The U.N. established its climate change body in 1992. We've now had 25 of these climate conferences since, and we've done more damage during that time with full knowledge of the problem, full knowledge of what we were doing, than we managed in all the century, in indeed all the millennia that came before, which is to say that it's not about somebody's great-great-grandfather in Manchester. It's about what we've done over the last 25 or 30 years, which has brought the planet from basically a state of stability to a state of crisis. And it's a discriminating crisis because in parts of the world like the US and Northern Europe, we're beginning to see the effects now, but in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, they are already suffering enormously, and in the decades ahead will suffer much, much more than we will. So while we're doing that damage, while we've done that damage and engineered this crisis, it is not us that is going to be experiencing the most intense impacts. So, and on top of all that, those people who've done so little also have the least resources to respond by, say, building seawalls or developing new kinds of crops. So they're kind of taking it on both ends, so to speak.
So this is a really, really important point here, and I just want to reiterate it because sometimes I think people don't fully – it's hard to fully digest the fact of what you just said, David, and that is, as you said, I'm just going to repeat it. In the lifetime of Joe Biden, 90% of the emissions that the United States has produced, right,
the entire world.
Okay, and then you also say that in the lifetime of the average American current age, about what, 30, mid 30s, mid to late 30s,
38, yeah,
yeah, 60% of all historical emissions. So just in the past 4 decades. So really, I think it's in order to. Let me put it this way. To sell the idea of climate reparations, it's important to emphasize that we, as you said, we're not actually talking about reparations for actions taken a century ago, but in fact, things that we, those of us who are living, are doing today. So give me a couple more examples here, because in your piece, you have just some jarring facts. Like, how much does one transatlantic airplane trip put into the atmosphere carbon-wise versus, you know, an individual living elsewhere in the world?
Yeah, every economy class seat on a transatlantic flight from, say, New York to Paris produces 1 ton of carbon dioxide, which is – it's really incredible to think about because this is a gas, and yet we're producing so much of it that it weighs, you know, the size of a small car. And that is more than the annual carbon footprint of the average annual carbon footprint of the more than 1 billion people who are living in sub-Saharan Africa. So every time one of us takes a one-way flight to Europe, we're doing more damage to the current state of the climate and the future of the planet than like whatever it is, 1.3 billion people each in their full years in sub-Saharan Africa are doing. When you think globally, you know, all of sub-Saharan Africa is responsible for, in total, I mentioned earlier the U.S. is responsible for about 1/5, 20% of all historical emissions. Sub-Saharan Africa, in total, all of those countries, is responsible for about 3% of those emissions. And many of those countries are going to be hit much, much harder than the U.S. It just shows you how gruesomely inequitable this system that we have imposed on the world by burning fossil fuels has been. And that it's related to our accumulation of wealth. If you look at the chart of the countries who have done the most damage, they are – it really is a chart of national wealth, because while we can now see a future in which we can produce green wealth and sort of prosperity that doesn't rely on fossil fuels, for all of human history, that hasn't been the case, which means that any country and really any person who has ever gotten rich in this world got rich to some degree because of development that was powered by this poisonous – product. And the wealth of nations essentially reflects how much damage we have done to the planet by using that poisonous product. And I think it's incumbent on us as individuals, more importantly as nations, because responsibility is not distributed equally among nations, but as the rich and powerful countries of the world, to really take seriously what it means that we've imposed this enormous burden on billions of people already living in poverty and faced with a much bleaker future than they would be if we hadn't polluted the atmosphere and poisoned our future.
Right. See, because this is what you call the clarifying moral logic of climate reparations, right? That's the phrase that you use in your piece, because it's hard, if not impossible, to argue against the idea that industrialization and factually carbon-driven industrialization are, you know, is the major factor that led to the accumulation of wealth for, as we're saying, the richest countries in the world, and the cumulative effect of that over time in terms of building economies. And so, therefore, you say that in a sense, that makes, if you're going to apply a moral reparations framework to the issue of climate, you say it's actually even more mathematically straightforward than the same conversation when it's had in the realm of reparations for slavery. So what do you mean by that?
Well, I think that if you look at the horrifying inequalities across racial lines in the U.S. today, how much poorer Black Americans are than white Americans. The causal system there is complicated. Obviously, slavery, the legacy of slavery, racism, redlining, they play a significant role. But it's hard to map out exactly how much is owed, how much was taken away. And so a lot of conversations about racial reparations end in a sort of vague, yes, of course, there is some moral debt that is owed. And yes, of course, in a just world, that debt would be repaid. But calculating it is a bit tricky. Where, like, actually, how many dollars are we talking about? Paid to whom? By whom? And that sort of thing. With climate, we know exactly how many gigatons of carbon, which is to say how many billions of tons of carbon the United States has put into the atmosphere in all of its history. And we have technology now. It's being run at a small scale, but we have it and it works, that can take that carbon out. We know how much it costs to do that. We can price it by the ton. And so if we multiply the number of tons that we've put into the atmosphere by the price of taking it out, we are literally calculating what it would cost to repair the damage of carbon emissions over all of American history. Now, that project is extremely expensive. When you multiply that one figure, the number of tons we've put up there, by the amount it would probably cost over the next couple of decades to take them out, you get an American debt of $50 trillion, and globally you get a bill of $250 trillion, which is more than half of all the wealth that exists in the world today. So it's an enormous undertaking, and I don't mean to suggest it would be as simple as snapping our fingers and saying, let's do this. There are huge engineering challenges and land use challenges, energy use challenges. We'd have to get through all of those. But as a way of just showcasing for Americans particularly, but really people anywhere in the global north, just how big our moral burden to those in the global South who are already suffering from this crisis really is, I think putting that dollar figure on that debt is hugely helpful. Of course, those are incomprehensible numbers to many of the people I spoke to in my article who are, you know, climate activists from Uganda and Kenya and India. The idea of a $50 trillion bill is unthinkable there. In the U.S., it is hard to imagine, but it's probably something on the order of about five times what we've paid in COVID relief, which means if 5 years ago it seemed to Americans truly unthinkable, now it may be edging into the hard to imagine but still conceivable, especially if, and this may be most important of all, we let the prospect of long-term carbon removal projects extend our timeline of action when it comes to climate change.
Yeah, so I'm going to want to talk with you about that in more detail in a little bit. But first of all, to be clear, this carbon reparations calculus that you just walked us through, again, like measuring how much we're putting into the atmosphere and the various costs associated with that, that $250 trillion bill, essentially, reparations bill for worldwide, and the $50 trillion portion owed by the United States. Just to be clear, you're not actually suggesting that, or are you, that we're talking about cash, like cash to the nations such as, you know, Bangladesh that we started the hour with, that in order to assist them in climate mitigation as the years go by?
Well, you know, the UN The rich countries in the world, starting at in the Copenhagen conference, I think, and then codified at the Paris conference in 2015, promised this $100 billion climate fund annually, $100 billion from the rich countries of the world to the poor countries of the world. You were talking about earlier in the show. I think it's just useful to begin with to compare these two numbers, $100 billion on the one hand, which the rich countries of the world have promised but have not yet fulfilled, and are asking this time in Glasgow for us to celebrate their repeated promise that they were now going to fulfill it. So this is, you know, with that number, $100 billion, which it seems about as much as we can ask of the rich countries of the world, with this other number, $250 trillion, which amounts to our total debt. That gap is enormous and really is the core of my perspective, that we are falling far short of what we need to do.
Okay.
We can talk about the practicalities, but at a moral level, we are woefully inadequate.
Well, let's do talk about the practicalities when we come back, because with this new moral framework in mind, I'm always eager to hear about what we can do about it. So David Wallace Wells, stand by for just a moment. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about applying a moral framework to the issue of climate change and asking whether or not the industrialized richest nations of the country actually owe reparations to largely the global south for the disproportionate impact that climate change is having on poorer nations around the world. David Wallace Wells joins us. He's deputy editor of New York Magazine and author of The Uninhabitable Earth. He's recently written an extended article in New York Magazine about morality and climate change. And we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. And David, before we actually get further into sort of what would reparations really practically look like, I do want to get a bit of a reality check in terms of what's happening at the UN Climate Conference in Glasgow at the moment. So for example, let's listen to the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Boris Johnson.
I was there with many of you in Copenhagen 11 years ago when we acknowledged we had a problem. I was there in Paris 6 years ago when we agreed to net zero and to try to restrain the rise in the temperature of the planet to 1.5 degrees. And all those promises will be nothing but blah, 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 to coin a phrase. And the anger and the impatience of the world will be uncontainable unless we make this COP26 in Glasgow the moment when we get real about climate change.
Will they get real, David? What do you think? Based on what you've heard so far.
I don't think the conference is going to produce a major step forward. I think what it is doing and will do is sort of commemorating or publicizing commitments and plans that have been made to this point, which are encouraging. We are looking at a relatively softer climate landing, I think, than we were just a few years ago. We've probably cut about 1 degree or maybe more of likely warming off of our at least median expected future for this century. And that's really significant. But we're still very, very far from the targets that were established at the Paris conference. 1.5 degrees or well below 2 degrees are the sort of two different ways of thinking about it. And we need to do much, much more than we're doing. That's probably not ultimately up to conferences like this. It's ultimately up to nations of the world to take action within their own borders and with their own legislation. And unfortunately, there's, I think, at the moment at least, a real growing gap between what countries are saying they want to do and what they're actually investing in and planning for.
Well, can we just talk about that in more detail, though? Because from your piece, you point out that, for example, even that $100 billion, right, that annual funding that was promised back in Paris in 2015, which hasn't been fully paid yet. I mean, you mentioned it, Prime Minister Hasina from Bangladesh. We played tape from her saying, pay what you've already promised, et cetera, et cetera. But the point is that you in your piece say that that countries, it's not as if they can't pay because they're already paying five times more than that in debt repayments individually than they are in their climate promises.
Yeah, and you know, the African countries of the world want basically a tenfold increase of that promise. And it's a hard enough fight to get the rich countries of the world to even honor the promise they've already made. So it's an uphill battle. Excuse me, 1 minute. it's you know, within domestic countries, you see more progress being made. You see more investment in the U.S. being made on the climate front, and there's a lot of action taking place outside of legislation, just because the market dynamics are changing so much. Renewable energy is now cheaper for 90% of the planet than dirty energy, which means that really, if market forces were really in control, we'd already be rapidly heading through a green transition, and we are moving somewhat quickly down that path and making those investments. But it's woefully inadequate when compared to what the scientists told us in 2018 was necessary to avoid what they call a catastrophic level of warming of 2 degrees Celsius. They said then, in 2018, that we needed a global World War II scale mobilization starting in 2019. They said that we needed to cut our emissions almost in half, cut them by 45% by 2030, and to get to net zero by 2050. We're very, very far off course there. You know, most of the commitments, the promising, exciting commitments that have been made over the last week, but also over the last months, are 2050 targets, which means that countries can make them without having to commit all that much today to making them real. But the truth is, if we're going to get to net zero in 2050, we sort of do have to get to 45% or 50% cuts by 2030. And we've done very, very little to make that happen.
Okay.
I think the world is finally heading in the right direction compared to where we were a few years ago. And we're seeing much more ambitious rhetoric, as we heard from Prime Minister Johnson, that's sweeping the world. But it's not – talk is not the same as action, as Greta Thunberg has reminded us again and again.
Without a doubt. I mean, and it is at this point in time just rhetoric. And there are hints in terms of what nations would be practically willing to do. And I'm going to stick with the money line here for just a moment, David, because as you pointed out in your piece, for example, when I believe it was some African nations suggested that an increase in how much the developed countries would pay to help climate mitigation efforts elsewhere. I mean, John Kerry, the U.S. envoy on climate, he's now centered this like latter part of his career around issues of climate. Would he even discuss the matter with other nations in Glasgow?
No, he said it was a non-starter. And this was an ask for $750 billion, which was actually – this is from a South African diplomat, which is actually smaller than a group of African nations were going to be asking for. They were asking for $1.3 trillion. And he wouldn't even discuss the $750 billion. And unfortunately – you know, on some level, this is quite familiar. You know, we can think about it in terms of vaccine diplomacy, where it would be very easy. It would have been very easy a year ago for even just the U.S. single-handedly to pay for the entire world to get vaccinated for COVID. And according to an analysis by, you know, quite conservative centrist economic institutes, it would have paid for itself 100 times over in terms of the economic benefits that would return to us because of a fully recovered world. And yet we didn't do that. Looking back further, we can think about, you know, the moral arguments of Peter Singer, all of the infomercials that we've seen on our televisions about famines in the developing world over all of our lives. You know, this problem of global inequality is an enduring one. It's one that people in the West are very disinterested in, to be generous about it. But I think it's something we really need to address head on in thinking about climate, because the real risk, as I see it, especially as we're engineering a slightly better future of, say, 2.5 degrees of warming this century, is that people in countries like ours will manage to adapt there'll be some impacts and suffering, but, you know, life will go on.
Yeah.
But in other parts of the world, the impacts will be so much more catastrophic. And I worry that we'll respond to that just by looking away.
Yeah. So, you know, I focused a lot on money at the moment, but you make the broader argument that reparations, climate reparations is, you expressly say, it is not just money alone. In fact, to use your language, that's sort of a deliberately naive way to start shaping what reparations might look like. We can also decarbonize, right, with more renewables, vastly more renewables. But you add another layer here, and I want to spend the last few minutes that we have exploring that, about carbon removal, in fact, that you think that you say that climate reparations can also come through the form of richer nations doing more to remove the carbon that they have already put into the atmosphere. Tell me what you mean.
Yeah, this is really taking seriously the idea of what the word reparations means, which is to say we could get all the way to zero carbon emissions tomorrow. We could even pay for the poor countries of the world to do the same and to spend money on adaptation. And they would still be dealing with some quite gruesome impacts at where we are today, about 1.3. I don't think we'll be able to stay below 1.5, but they're going to be serious impacts almost no matter how quickly we move. We need to move very quickly, but they're going to be serious impacts we have to deal with. If we find a way to at scale remove carbon from the atmosphere, we could actually bring that temperature rise down. Now, it would take probably decades and maybe even centuries. It would be extremely expensive. It would require global infrastructure at a scale beyond today's oil and gas business. There's no market for this activity at all at the moment. So unless we devise one, it would have to be entirely publicly funded. But we have machines today that do precisely this. They take carbon out of the atmosphere and can store it underground permanently. We could also do this through tree planting and other kinds of what are called nature-based solutions. But those are a little trickier to manage, in part because, you know, so many trees are burning these days. So you lose that carbon storage every time there's a wildfire. If you bury it underground, it's a much more permanent solution. There are companies doing this today for about $500 a ton. But most analysts think that if we give some meaningful support to it over the next few years, we should be able to bring it down, the cost down to as little as $100 a ton over the next decade or so, which is the number that I base my math on. And that number is still higher than it costs to avoid putting carbon in the atmosphere in the first place. You know, if you put a carbon tax of $100 out there, we decarbonize really rapidly. So this is not a substitute for rapid decarbonization. But if we get to net zero, and then as we're doing that, we build out this fleet of carbon removal machines, we can just sort of let them run over the course of, say, a century or two centuries. And if they run that long, they can bring us the carbon concentrations down from where they are today, about 415 parts per million, maybe 420, past 400, down to what's called the safe level of 350, and even in theory back down to the pre-industrial level of 280 parts per million, which means we would still have to deal with some risks of certain climate systems being triggered into feedback loops.
Yeah.
But in general, we could sort of return, restore, repair the climate that we inherited before we embarked on the Industrial Revolution. In theory, it's, as I said, it's extremely complicated, and all the same human challenges that stand in the way of rapid decarbonization, stand in the way of carbon removal. But because we could theoretically do it over the course of a century or two, it also means that we can sort of think a little more broadly and a little more in more liberated ways about the political structures we could develop to govern that undertaking, which makes me, at least, I'm a climate alarmist, I'm a climate, you know, skeptic of fast change based on where we've been. It makes me a little more hopeful about the future.
Well, can you give me the 10-second description of what these carbon removal machines look like, or what are they?
They kind of look like giant air conditioners. You know, they suck air through a filter, they capture the carbon, and then they condense it in one of a variety of ways, cool it, and bury it underground. It's sort of like you're reversing the flow of the Industrial Revolution. If that was taking coal out, burning it, turning it into smoke, this is taking the smoke, condensing it, and burying it back underground.
Okay, so I can imagine there are a lot of energy issues around those machines as well, but that's a conversation for another day, because those machines are one part of the overall argument that David Wallace Wells makes about climate reparations. And he's written about it in New York Magazine. We have a link to it at onpointradio.org. And David's also author of The Uninhabitable Earth. Thank you so much for joining us today, David.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we have spent this hour talking in detail about the impacts of climate change, the disproportionate impacts on the global South. But let's bring it back here, back home for just a moment, because, of course, we are seeing, with every passing year, greater climate impacts in the United States. For example, Colleen Swan, she is the interim city administrator at Kivalina in Alaska, Kivalina, Alaska. And there, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has predicted that coastal erosion and rising sea levels could render Kivalina completely uninhabitable by 2025. That's just 4 years from today. So for Swan and the members of the indigenous Inupiat community who live on Kivalina, climate change isn't a remote abstraction. It's an emergency that is threatening their lives right now.
Kivalina sits on a sand spit. It's a little island, and it's surrounded by water. We have the lagoon on one side and two channels on either end and the ocean, Chukchi Sea. When the fall storms come, they come from the south, and that's our most vulnerable side of the island. And, you know, I grew up watching these things, subtle changes that started interrupting with our own societal systems. The fall sea storms, they're a given. They happen every fall. But one year in 2004, suddenly land started falling into the ocean. And so when the land starts falling away, you're just a couple of feet away from the residential homes. And that's something that I didn't understand. You know, some of our elders started saying the ice is not there to buffer those annual fall storms, to buffer the waves, and so we were defenseless. And unless you stand on a rock, your sandcastle is going to disintegrate. What I've heard from my elders is, you know, every time there is a disruption to anything, like to the migration of the caribou or the beluga whale, they come back. You know, little interruptions by industrial development, but they always come back. But it became consistent, the changes. They were not going back to the way they were. Even bearded seal hunting is happening 2 weeks earlier consistently and not going back to the way it was the year before or 5 years before. It seemed permanent. I mean, in every part of this whole human systems, they're going to have to adapt to. What you take for granted today is not going to be there if we don't start working now to figure out what we're going to be left with in the end. We are going to starve. We won't have jobs. I mean, we as a people are on our own. I'm a grandmother. In fact, I'm a great-grandmother. Now, your children are not going to live the life you lived. If we don't figure out these things and bring Western science and traditional knowledge together, they're going to have to solve this problem. You look at your little 4-year-old, your little 8- or 9-year-old grandchild, you realize you're leaving them with the problems that you can't fix now. They're going to have to figure it out. Look at your children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren and think about it.
Colleen Swan, interim city administrator in Kivalina, Alaska. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.